Welcome back to Revisiting Smith's Point, the re-listen podcast where I take you episode by episode through a rewatch podcast for Bill Craig's 70s sitcom gem. Welcome to episode one. Today we'll be dissecting season one, episode one of Revisiting Smith's Point, which evaluates season one, episode one of the television program Smith's Point, entitled I Do Not. But first, let's begin by discussing more generally the title of the podcast and the username through which it's curated. The particular podcast we're speaking of today is entitled Revisiting Smith's Point, which immediately in its verbiage introduces an element of resuscitation, something that will align more generally with the piece's themes of circularity and oblique recollection. The title exists as a verb adjacent to a proper noun, which means that there's structurally a built-in notion that the curator of the podcast, who doesn't have a name, will be acting upon Smith's Point in some way during the podcast, in this case, revisiting it. Further, there's implied passage of time in the verb itself, and although linear time is not always canonically reliable in Smith's Point, from a figurative standpoint, there is the notion in this language that the proper noun, that Smith's Point, is an entity of its own occurrence, which exists in at least three periods: the time of the enactor's initial visitation, the period of obstruction between the enactor's visitation and revisitation, and the revisitation. This assumes, of course, that there is a muscularity to the revisitation, that what's being revisited still exists in more than memory, which we can confirm this in the podcast because of the references to the box set, and because generally the podcast exists regarding content that can be found fairly easily. This three-pronged period also presupposes, however, and this is more complicated, that Smith's Point did not exist before the initial visitation, which is to say that in the world of the podcast, the show was created as it was watched, which, obviously, this isn't literally true. It aired on ABC whether or not the speaker was watching. But we can posit it as true because the podcast is framed through a personalized revisitation, which inherently assumes the inciting event to be a personalized visitation. The language of visitation further creates these dynamic spider branches of enactor and object in terms of the content we might expect to follow. There's questions here not fully answered in the first episode in regard to stagnancy versus dynamism in either party during the aforementioned period of obstruction. Is the revisitation an exact replica of the initial relationship between an actor and object, neither changed? Or has one changed and the other remained unchanged, making the event grounded both in past and present? Or have both changed, and so there is no longer any hope of contextualization to the meeting, just sort of two distorted entities colliding but neither recognizing the other? Something like postmodernism, which is a term the speaker uses incessantly and almost always without meaning in this episode, which is in itself postmodern. Each module of revisitation would imply a different story, and it's impossible to know in this first episode what the specific permutation of the relationship is, partially because we learn so little about the speaker here. My best estimate, however, based on the information learned in this first episode, is that it is a combination of the second and third mutative option. It is reasonable to conclude that the speaker has changed in some way since their initial visitation, because there has been a passage of time, and because we know, or at least presuppose, the speaker to be a person existing in the literal world as we understand it. It would also be reasonable to conclude that Smith's Point as an entity has not changed since the initial visitation, because it is content which exists only once in the eternal present, is captured, and then cycled again and again and again. To problematize this, I think the argument could be made that while the content of the sitcom doesn't change in an athletic way, the show does in fact change with the passage of time, that, for instance, if you watched the pilot episode on the 18th of April in 1983, it would, in a way, be an entirely different episode than if you watched the pilot episode on the 17th of April in 1983, because you would in one occurrence be watching it on the 18th, and in the next be watching it on the 17th, that the consumption is always occurring in codependence with the eternal present, so the material is always, always changing. Not to mention, in a more academic sense, our perception of the content is changing with the intersective stories of the contemporary time, and because our understanding of the content partially creates the content itself changes from view to view. So already in revisiting Smith's point, there are many stories. The grammatical story of object and an actor in the title, the implied story of dissonance in revisitation versus visitation, and, as we'll speak of momentarily, the flowering stories of assumption and implication by the listening audience based upon the title made independent of the content it describes. And so already, like the speaker alludes to in this first episode, there is this notion of a thousand stories unfurling all at once. We speak so specifically of the name of things here because the lens the speaker themselves takes is so particular and so name-obsessed. Furthering into our investigation of the title past mere grammar, we can speak of the names as dressings on the content, and the implications of said names when made separate from the content itself. Revisiting Smith's point is the dressing laid upon the content of the podcast, which is difficult to describe sans name. But it also exists as something of a gateway to the content itself, in that it creates a figurative and literal expectation for what is to follow. Figuratively, we have addressed revisitation, an actor, an object, etc., but let's speak more literally here. The title creates something of a double-branching expectation, which is personalized to your previous experience of Smith's point. I'll say here that I think the speaker overestimates in this episode the number of people who will be intimately familiar with the show, because although I'm sure the numbers are approximately right in terms of viewership for the general American population, I think they ought be adjusted with acknowledgement that the medium of podcast is not as popular with the demographic of people who would have been at the appropriate age to watch the show when it first aired. So there is, acknowledging that true binary almost never exists, a sort of binary of expectation for people who read the title of the podcast. There is the expectation for those who know Smith's Point as a television show, and for those who don't. For the people who are familiar with Smith's Point, the television show, the title would likely create an accurate expectation for the content that's to follow, that a person will be looking back at the television show Smith's Point in some way. Of note here is the spider branch that while revisitation grammatically implies an initial visitation, in terms of literal application of this language, we cannot assume an initial visitation from the speaker. There is the possibility that revisitation is only in reference to the outdated nature of the show itself, that any sort of visitation to Smith's Point would be a revisitation, because we are no longer existing in a period in which Smith's Point is actively creating itself. The second expectation created by the title Revisiting Smith's Point is relevant to the people who aren't aware of Smith's Point as a television show, and it is a false expectation which flowers off into many colors of falseness. The expectation of revisitation being set by the verb, the permutation of assumption will be based entirely on the consumer's experience of the noun Smith's Point, which in this context has multiple meanings. There is Smith's Point in Manchester by the Sea, for instance, which is where the show figuratively takes place, but there is also Smith's Point on Fire Island. Or, the person might have no understanding of any real Smith's Points, and for this reason create a kind of stand-in place, somewhere they believe to be standing in for an either real or fictional location, and in this replacement actually create another mutation of Smith's Point. The assumptions branch out here too, because there is no grammatical indication towards whether or not the podcast is fiction or non-fiction. A person might assume it to be an audio drama about a fictional person revisiting a made-up place, or a person might assume it to be a tightly researched appraisal of a real person revisiting a real physical place. And all of these assumptions would be wrong because Smith's Point doesn't refer to a place at all, but a television show. So there is sort of a trapdoor element to the title, Unless you have a special secret knowledge, you will be imperfectly creating assumption for the content, and in this way imperfectly receiving the content. This also introduces for us the notion of single things existing with multiple meanings, some of which may or may not be correct. And this is a notion, particularly as it pertains to names having multiple interpretations, that will come up time and again in this episode, most significantly in the names of the characters themselves. Because the podcast is so carefully curated, it is worth noting how and when structural information is distributed. There is story, for example, in the selection of the title to represent the podcast, which might serve to some as an actual obstruction towards the truth of the content. Because of this careful and specific eye towards facilitation of the content of the podcast, I think it's worth briefly investigating also the name through which the podcast is published, which is Re Smith's Point. That's R.E. Smith's Point, all is one word. Firstly, I think it's of note that this is another instance in which we cannot, despite names and their many meanings being somewhat central to the discourse of this episode, and also, it seems, to the world of Smith's Point, identify the actual name of the speaker. It is another instance in which the identity of the creator is obstructed and, if we assume intention, obstructed purposefully. Secondly, there's the notion that the title is mutated here. It's both abbreviated and presented without spaces, although the capitalizations still stand, in an interface that would allow enough room for the full title to exist with spaces. It's not explicitly stated in this episode, but I think we can presuppose an interest in abbreviations and name theory because of the interest in Joyce, and specifically in the discourse orbiting the character of Anne Olivia Plurabelle, not Plurabella, as the speaker says, in Finnegan's Wake, who is known through an abbreviation. The title then structurally implies a truncation of some kind, an abbreviation which, as with ALP and Anne Olivia, perhaps represents just as fully the thing it abbreviates. There's a twin meaning in the abbreviation too, in that RE could be short for regarding, as is more commonly used in that abbreviation, particularly in email correspondence, or revisiting, which would make more sense knowing the name of the show. Re also, of course, being the Latin prefix for again, there is a reading of this name which something of Smith's Point happening again, the againness of Smith's Point, which ties into the circularity of Smith's Point and its adjacent works. I'll finish our discussion on name by briefly clocking a final twin meaning, this time in the titles of the episodes. The titles of the episodes of Smith's Point are typical for the era, usually short, catchy, sometimes wordplay-involved tags which are related to the content of the episode itself. In the case of I Do, Not, there is a hook in the subversion of the expectation of the wedding vows, which also allows the audience to guess that the story might involve a wedding of some kind, which experiences some uncertainty. Revisiting Smith's Point, however, uses a more clinical naming device. The episodes are titled both for how they canonically exist in the podcast, and also the episode of Smith's Point that they are regarding. For example, episode 1 of the podcast is titled Season 1, Episode 1, meaning that it is both Season 1, Episode 1 of Revisiting Smith's Point, and that it is an analysis of Season 1, Episode 1 of Smith's Point. So already before the content of the podcast is even accessed, there is twin meaning, obstruction, mystery, and an almost sort of maddening banality in trying to understand or untangle any meaning from it. Despite this being the first episode of the podcast, the cold open begins mid-sentence on the word and. The speaker describes a moment in a piece of narrative art, it's unclear if it's a movie, book, television program, play, etc., in which a 400-year-old character named Cunegonde enters a space, with a character named Sarah, quote, still being in the room in this adaptation. The speaker then very briefly describes a speech given by the character Cunegonde, in which she, Cunegonde, announces that she's lived through many atrocities, and that she's ready for her kiss from someone named Candide. To begin, I think it's of note, and maybe this is a stretch, that the first lines of this opening potentially evoke Nicki Minaj's Woolly Mammoth interview for Ice Age 4 Continental Drift, in which there's also an excerpted and unusual description of a character, which, If this is even obliquely a reference to that interview, there exists a date for the world of the podcast, canonically, in that it must take place after the release of Ice Age 4 Continental Drift, or at least after the release of that interview. But this is speculation, and it's maybe extraneous and unnecessary because it's not entirely parallel to the interview, and more of a spiritual evocation, and because I haven't yet decided if we'll assume purpose or not in this podcast. The scene and the speech itself is especially interesting. The listener might assume that what is being described is in some way related to Voltaire's Candide, because that story features characters named Cunegonde and Candide, and those names aren't so common that they appear in unison often except in discussions of that specific work. But there is not much information offered in the way of locating the scene, either in medium or content, only that the scene is featured in an adaptation of another story. Again, here we can assume that it is an adaptation of Candide, although potentially that isn't true at all, and this is a work which contains these characters named such in homage or parody in some way to Candide, or perhaps accidentally. The assumption might also initially be that this is a reference to the Bernstein operetta, which, like Smith's Point itself, featured something of an ensemble of writers, because the operetta is the most known adaptation of the work, and indeed in some cases supersedes the work itself in things such as search results and immediate assumption. I did some research into Candide and the operetta adaptation, however, and neither features a character named Sarah, and in neither is Cunegonde shown at the age of 400, which, those of course are two of the only discerning factors established in this cold open. I thought initially that the name of the old woman might be Sarah, but this isn't true. Her name is never revealed, which also obliquely ties to our discussion of named versus not. This revelation led to a search more specifically for the character of Sarah in relation to the character of Candide, which revealed what I think to be the text described in this cold open, which is Mark Ravenhill's adaptation of Candide, originally produced by the Royal Shakespeare Company on August 29, 2013. Mark Ravenhill is an English dramatist and journalist most associated with the in-your-face theater movement, popularized in Europe in the late 90s. His plays include Mother Clap's Molly House, Some Explicit Polaroids, and Pool, No Water. And since his writing debut in 1995, he's become one of the most widely produced playwrights in England, and one of the most widely produced HIV-positive playwrights in the world. Spoilers for Candide and for Mark Ravenhill's Candide to follow. Ravenhill's particular adaptation of Candide begins with a play within a play. Candide has been taken in by a countess who's commissioned a playwright to write his, Candide's, life story in order to cheer him up. The adaptation starts with the play, and so immediately we have to cut through layers and layers of metafiction to reach the real story, Candide watching a play about Candide in an adaptation of Candide, and in this case of Revisiting Smith's Point, the additional layer of removal in that the story is only being recalled and not itself played. Eventually, Candide leaves this play within a play, and his story plays out intermixed with a contemporary story of a woman named Sarah, whose daughter commits a mass shooting. Sarah writes a book to make sense of the act through its narrativization, and becomes entangled in selling the film rights to the story. At the end of the play, she visits the Pangloss Institute, which has, with the help of the still-living Dr. Pangloss, developed a medication to create universal optimism. Sarah awakens Candide from a 400-year slumber in the hope that he will align with her campaign against universal optimism, which he refuses. The final scene of the play involves Candide finally reuniting with Cunegonde, but finding her to be unrecognizably ugly and horrible. It's the first instance of Cunegonde appearing on stage in this adaptation, and the speech she gives, which is one of the longest speeches in the show, is something of the heart of the piece. She describes in detail the atrocities she's lived through, a survey of the genocide, natural disasters, war, and disease that has befallen the world since the initial publication of Voltaire's Candide, and she returns continually to the refrain of "kiss me," the notion of this kiss being the only thing that has propelled her through it all. Candide, although he no longer loves her, kisses her, and Sarah kills herself. It's classically Ravenhill in its near-comic bleakness, and a much harsher ending than the original Voltaire. The choice to describe this monologue and reference this specific work is noteworthy. Firstly, there's an element of mystery in that the context of the description never explains itself. It relies on the consumer to uncover context for themselves. It also is a purposeful selection of an adaptation of a work of art, and not only that, but an adaptation which itself deals with several layers of metafiction and removal. To address the elephant in the room, structurally, the cold open leads the consumer to believe, because of their understanding of the form of cold open in this context, that the clip is an excerpt from a complete thought, and that it will be played later in context in the episode. This is not the case for episode 1 of Revisiting Smith's Point. Candide is mentioned again in its context within a lineage of, quote, postmodern, noir-y works, which I'm not sure I agree at all with that appraisal, we'll discuss that later, but in no way is the Ravenhill adaptation referenced, and this clip is never replayed. So the cold open is something of a lie, another trapdoor. It sets up a false expectation for completion. It's something that's only indirectly, if at all, related to the content of the podcast, although it leads you to believe it will in some way link up or connect. There's the question here of constellation versus stars. When things like this happen in the podcast, do we attempt to weave them into the overall tapestry of the work, or accept them as something of a random misfiring? I take a cue from the podcast facilitator in assuming purpose for this cold open, but I don't think I can articulate how it fits directly into the world of Revisiting Smith's Point, other than those few disparate threads we've already discussed, the Candide connection, the notion of obstruction, adaptation. It feels like a clue in a mystery we haven't yet learned. Also, there are two things of note, I think, in relation to the speaker himself in this cold open. The first is the quality of his voice. There's an almost Mary Tyrone Harper Pitt aspect of depressive dissociation in the voice, a tiredness. This warms up a bit in the episode, but particularly in the cold open, there's a sad flatness to it, which again raises the question of, is this part of the story or not? And it's unclear because, as I've said and will continue to say, almost nothing is revealed in this episode about the speaker. I haven't listened to further episodes yet, although I will for further episodes of this podcast, but my assumption is that either gradually more and more will be learned about the speaker, or that there will always be something of a conspicuous lack of context regarding them. The second thing of note in regard to the speaker is the secondary direct address, the "I'm ready for my kiss. I'm ready for my kiss, Candide." There's a reading of this opening in which the speaker is meaningfully trying to communicate with someone through all these layers of removal, the notion that the speaker has become so shipwrecked in fear and discourse that the only viable means of direct communication is through these layers. There's also a reading, however, that the cold open is a clue to a mystery unrelated to the speaker personally, and that part of the flatness is an almost self-consciousness at the previous interpretation, a fear that the fragment will be misconstrued as personal, that the star will be grouped in the wrong constellation. There's an element of asymmetry, of interruption, in that the theme starts before the cold open is entirely finished. There's an imperfect completion which continues from the cold open beginning mid-sentence to this interrupted ending for the cold open, and interrupted beginning for the theme. I recognize the tune of this theme as a modified version of the waltz played in episode 3 of Smith's Point, the episode where they're at the birthday party, only there's an element of removal, of adaptation, in that this isn't a sound clip from the episode. It's a cover of the song played on toy piano, which raises, of course, this sort of philosophical question of, if the same note is played on a different instrument, is it a different note? Does it have a different meaning? If we're to extract any sort of meaning from this music in the podcast, does the meaning change in adaptation? And of course, it literally does change in this theme, because there's an addition of a dissonant chord, which seems to say that there is something in this podcast, or at least in this cover of the waltz, that is not all the way right, something lurking and hidden. But there's not time either to dwell on the dissonance or the theme, because like the cold open, this theme is overtaken by the next section before it has time for perfect completion, and so nothing in the first section of the episode is neatly resolved. I tried to do some research on the waltz theme, and I believe it was written specifically for that third episode, although I can't identify exactly by who. Probably Moira Armstrong, because she composed most of the incidental music for the first season. I think it's worth noting that the theme of this podcast is not a modified version of the Smith's Point theme song, also written by Armstrong, but rather a modified version of the waltz, which only appears in one episode. I can't find this cover anywhere, so I'm assuming it was done by the speaker themselves. The choice of toy piano sticks out, particularly as it pertains to David Greenspan, who the speaker will mention later on in the episode as someone they admire. David Greenspan, of course, collaborated with Stephen Merritt on a musical adaptation of Coraline, another instance of adaptation and removal appearing in the podcast, which was almost entirely composed for and orchestrated by toy piano. The word salad of the introductory sentence alone is almost impenetrable. Hello and welcome to Revisiting, which is a sort of present tense introduction to an action rooted in past tense interface, complicated only further by the fact that this is episode one, so figuratively there is nothing to revisit. The world just began itself, so there's no space for reflection. I'd also like to briefly discuss the speaker's appraisal of the show as a, quote, sitcom gem, in that it seems an unusual placement of opinion on the show, something the speaker rarely does outright, although of course there is an implied love for and even obsession with the show and the project itself, in the meticulous discussion of the piece. It seems unlikely that a person would invest so much time and research into something that they hated, although certainly it is possible. We'll hear later that Smith's Point exists at the intersection of things that the speaker loves, but we'll never hear explicitly that the speaker loves Smith's Point. As we'll discuss, there's very few instances in this episode of specific judgments occurring in regard to the material of Smith's Point, and overall, save for a few exceptions right at the beginning, a certain preference towards passive language in the description of the work. This seems connected to the limiting of information about the speaker himself, but it is, at least in this episode, never specifically stated what this connection might be, or why either limitation is occurring. One theory, for instance, would be that the passive voice is preferred to create a kind of discursive authority. This is accepted in an integral part of the podcast, however, and the immediate sort of subtitle to the piece, a quick summation of what Smith's Point is, which, according to the speaker, is a 70s sitcom gem. 70s and sitcom are largely indisputable descriptors of the show here and sort of concrete name dressing to put on it, but gem is subjective and skewed positive. The popular connotation, particularly as it pertains to the phrase hidden gem, is that the object is something with which limited interaction has been had, but with which interaction is enjoyable. There's an implied dissonance in the sort of worldly loss occurred by the fact that many people have gone around interacting with many things, but few have interacted with the quote-unquote gem, which is very pleasurable to interact with, so there's a missed opportunity for pleasure. The podcast doesn't specify hidden gem, but its shadow lingers enough in the context of the use, and also in the, quote, lack of recognition the speaker will discuss later, that there's sort of this implied narrative of Smith's Point being a particularly pleasurable TV show to interact with, and one which perhaps more people, if they knew about it or had known about it, would have or might interact with and be pleased by it. The speaker then does something that they'll do frequently throughout the rest of the episode, which is they announce what they are going to do structurally before doing it. This is obviously the first thing you're taught not to do in writing an essay, and in this context, I think it betrays either a kind of self-consciousness about the curation or creation of the podcast, or a kind of carefulness regarding the audience in the need to clue them in what is going to happen before it happens, even if it is something as innocuous as an introduction, which, as we've stated, is really a non-introduction, a sort of vague assortment of facts about the speaker, which never really return in any way, but the tertiary way they relate to the content of the podcast itself. The speaker prepares us for the following: an introduction as to who they are and why they're doing this, and then the providing of some background on Smith's Point for those who aren't familiar with the show. We are then provided with the only three facts we will ever receive in this episode about the speaker's personal life. They are, number one, the speaker is a writer, number two, the speaker lives in Vermont, number three, the speaker has an interest in theater literature, queer history, 70s pop culture, and, quote, all that is tangled up in Smith's Point as a piece of media. Starting with the second piece of information, I think it's interesting that the speaker, who uses so much parsimony in self-description, chooses to partially identify themselves by their physical location, which seems to suggest that physical location is in fact part of a person's identity, and that identity is in some way, quote, tangled up in physical location. This branches off in a few ways, one being that Smith's Point itself is a piece of media which very much self-identifies by location, a false location in several ways, in that the show was not actually filmed in Manchester by the Sea, and that the physical location of many of the episodes doesn't actually exist. There's a second connection between England and the East Coast in the speaker's description of their location as in, quote, New England, and this also raises a question regarding the specificity of the location. Why the speaker didn't choose a more identifiable or traceable location to place themselves in, New England being a region of six states. This is incongruous with the way in which Smith's Point self-identifies, that being a very particular reference to location, although it does open the possibility that the speaker is in fact recording from the actual Smith's Point in Manchester by the Sea, Massachusetts, or somewhere nearby. Questions arise with the location naming around the necessity for privacy on the part of the speaker, and questions as to whether this is an external or internal necessity. An external necessity would, for example, be that the speaker is being stalked, and is careful not to give away their location too specifically so that their stalker will not be able to find them. An internal necessity would be a shyness or need for privacy. The effect on the consumer is a neutrality that is, of course, not a neutrality at all, but a more conspicuous thriftiness, made only more conspicuous by its unexplained existence. This thriftiness continues in the speaker's self-description of themselves as a writer, which of course doesn't define the medium of writing which is primary or of greatest interest to the speaker. This means that there's no indication as to what exactly they write, although one might assume that it is something academic or in media studies, based on the very existence of Smith's Point, and particularly with the speaker's interest in documenting Smith's Point, which, again, I'll reemphasize, that this doesn't seem to be an archival process that would be of interest to someone not professionally related in some way to Smith's Point or the medium of Smith's Point. This self-description is stimulating because it may or may not be a definition based on the job or labor process of the speaker, because it's unclear as to whether or not writing is the profession of the speaker, or if the speaker self-identifies as a writer despite holding another position, which there's maybe even some commentary here about labor as identity in a capitalist system. The notion of a, quote, writer living in New England is also evocative potentially of the literary persona of the prominent writers of New England, the more serious, reclusive people such as Thoreau and O'Neill. This is an identity at odds with the structure of Smith's Point, which is at its core the examination of something considered very flimsy or silly. The medium of a sitcom, which speaks in a larger sense to the constant juxtaposition of Smith's Point, the application of a very serious sort of stuffy academic language to a piece of media which might be traditionally considered not as serious as the language used to describe it. This raises, if even obliquely, one of the major conflicts in the first episode of Smith's Point, which is the power of language versus the power of content, and whether language can change content by its framing or, alternately, if content has the ability to rob language of its very power. A question arrives at the end of the experience of listening to the first episode of Smith's Point as to whether or not the framing of the sitcom in such a way elevates the sitcom to something of a mythic narrative, or if doing so only actually robs the very decoding process and language used of its meaning. The speaker next lists several of their interests, which they claim are, quote, tangled up with Smith's Point as a piece of media. I think this sentence is worth examining for several reasons. Firstly, the verb tangled establishes a nuanced relationship between Smith's Point and the ideas mentioned, theater literature, queer history, and 70s pop culture, in that it implies that a perfect or most basic version of Smith's Point is not only fluid, but also without interaction with these ideas, but that Smith's Point has in some way become entangled or involved with these ideas because it is not in its purely realized form. This is supported in the structure of the podcast itself, which discusses Smith's point from a perspective of the outside looking in, meaning that it looks not just purely at the narrative of Smith's point, but also how it was created, by who, and how this creative process was affected by the different stories of the people involved. This is yet another example of a vaguely defining characteristic for the speaker, which reveals only shapes of what is the surely more specific and complicated reality. None of these three topics, theater literature, queer history, or 70s pop culture, is specific enough that one might assume the speaker is a specialist in any of the three, and indeed, to an extent, they are vague enough to encompass an almost infinite number of materials, which, this is in direct conflict structurally with the specificity of the lens the speaker takes with Smith's point. The assumption could be made that a person interested in speaking so specifically about a piece of media would then also be interested in speaking specifically about their interests, but they're not. And so another phantom is created, another vague mystery illuminated by the suggestion that the truth in its purest form is being somehow obstructed or not really alluded to. The speaker also betrays in this third episode a verbal tic they possess, which is the phrase, sort of. Many sort ofs show up in this episode, usually, but not always, as something of a self-conscious diluting of the impact of the sentence, potentially a fear or otherwise aversion to a clear and definite expression. The constant use of qualifiers in the speaker's sentences also, in a way, alludes to the sort of unknowable and expanding nature of things, the idea that true, definite expression or definition is actually impossible, and that the best a person can really do is the suggestion of something. There's maybe even the positing here that suggestion carries more truth than definition, because it accounts for the changing nature of object. I'll also reference here a slight whistling S from the speaker, not quite a lisp, but the allusion to a lisp, which only becomes more pronounced as the speaker continues to speak and presumably as their voice gets more tired. The speaker then describes why they started the podcast. There's another oxymoron in this phrasing as the speaker says they quote, noticed a lack of recognition in regard to the show, which ties back to our previous discussion of conspicuous absence in revisiting Smith's point. I'll also note a grammatical error in the speech here. The speaker says in regards to, when the correct form of the phrase is in regard to. This is an error which the speaker will replicate almost every time the phrase is used, making it unclear as to whether or not the mistake is intentional and meant to draw attention to itself, or a failing on the part of the speaker to understand the grammatically correct turn of phrase. The speaker then presents a hypothesis as to why Smith's point exists in this area of conspicuous absence, which is that it was lost in society's transition to DVD over VHS. This speculation brings up questions of the role of housing and location of archive as curator for our cultural identity, and subsequently the power not only of the people in charge of translation from medium to medium, but also of the people in charge of creating that which houses content in the first place, the physical curators. There is the physical curation of object housing, and then the translation of content from housing to housing, which, as revisiting Smith's point and Smith's point will argue, changes the content itself, and so we are always experiencing a more and more diluted version of the story. In the case of Smith's point, as curated through revisiting Smith's point, the implication is that the show was so unsuccessful, the notion of the show as at least a commercial or capital failure will be enforced later in the speaker's discussion of Bill Craig, that it was not deemed worthy of translation from medium to medium. The question of the party responsible for this appraisal has myriad answers. It's possible that the network deemed the show unworthy of translation because they didn't feel it a good representation of their company. It's possible that the parent company of the network deemed that the cost of translation would be greater than the sales revenue of a Smith's Point DVD set, which, clearly at one time this wasn't thought to be true as a VHS box set exists. I can confirm personally the existence of this VHS box set, although I confess I watched the first episode of Smith's Point on Vimeo in preparation for this podcast. My box set is somewhere deeply buried at my parents' old home. It's also possible that a less capitalistic and more philosophical judgment was made, meaning that the head of these curators, these translators, decided that Smith's Point was not an overarching narrative worthy of passing down, of remembering, thus curating it out of existence, which, to an extent, the modern curator's job is to ornament and obscure content first out of meaning and then out of existence. This is one of the first instances in the podcast in which definitive truth is questioned, and also one of the first moments in the show which implies that the podcast is partially, if not entirely, colored by the speaker's perception not only of the show itself, but also of the cultural context of the show as it existed then and as it exists now. It is a hypothesis which presupposes that the speaker is correct about there being a general lack of recognition in regard to Smith's Point, and then further, one which acknowledges its own possibility of falsehood. The speaker also makes the claim that there is a lack of information regarding Smith's Point, which is again a definitive statement derived entirely from the speaker's perception, and one which the audience can only accept as true if they believe the speaker to not only always be telling the truth, but also to be a shrewd discerner of information and of fact from fiction. In fact, the experience of listening to this episode, which is both informational and interpretive, presupposes a certain trust in the speaker to always be speaking from a place of knowledge and to always be telling the truth. I wonder if we can assume this, and, to be transparent, I'm not entirely sure, based specifically on a conflict between the speaker's description of one of the later scenes in the episode and my personal experience of the scene. Then questions flower off about what purpose the speaker might have for recording and putting this podcast out into the world, if not for an informative appraisal of Smith's Point. I'll also note the use of the word we here, which feels pointed in its locating of the speaker amongst a sort of hoi polloi of popular consumption. It seems a tactical move which forces the audience to identify in some way with the speaker despite the lack of definitive information as to their identity, which raises, is specific identity necessary to authentically locate an external party in the populace, and is specific identity necessary for the establishment of emotional camaraderie? The speaker also uses the word presently, which is outdated the minute it's uttered. From the time the word was spoken to recorded to released to heard, there is no possible way, unless a non-linear understanding of time is upheld, that the speaker is able to appraise any relevant present to the consumer of revisiting Smith's Point. And in the case of this statement, there's no way for the speaker to know that Smith's Point will still be sparsely available at the time of listening. In fact, there's already some discrepancy in the truth of this statement. As of my recording this podcast, Smith's Point is not widely available on Vimeo, non-mirrored episodes have begun to be pulled presumably for copyright reasons, and several account owners have set their remaining Smith's Point videos to private. I was able to watch the first episode, for example, because it was mirrored, and thereby less susceptible to a copyright pull, and of course this raises, I watched not only a different, but an extremely different episode from the speaker, in that I watched it on a different medium and I watched it backwards in its composition. I'll also note here the crossing of mediums in regard to the speaker's language about the box set. The speaker says that the box set has, quote, gone out of print, which is of course philosophically true in our ability to understand and recontextualize the phrase out of print, but also something of a false mixing of form-specific language. The story of Smith's Point as it exists on the VHS tape is not a print object, and so the phrase out of print incorrectly categorizes it as such. The speaker then specifies their ostensible reasons for creating the show, which is, and we'll note the word partially here as another deflection of definitive statement or description of the changing nature of reason, to provide commentary and to further document the show. The word commentary in this case presumably alludes to the sort of denarrativizing and interpretive elements of the show, as very few judgments are cast in terms of quality or effectiveness. Questions of the definition of commentary and its purpose arise here, in that the very word sort of holds a wide range of definitions with various connotations in various worlds. For example, a commentary track on a popular film might be entirely separate from the narrative of the film, a constant and purposeful shattering of the suspension of disbelief, and free from any specific or authoritative appraisals of the work. whereas a commentary on the very same film might contain a scathing consideration of the content itself, framed and experienced through the world outside the film. This is only part of the purpose, however, and quote, documentation is the second. We're told effectively that the podcast will perform two actions simultaneously, the creation of commentary around a work, and the documentation of the work around which the commentary is being formed, which it is impossible then perhaps to create an authentic or naked documentation of the work, as it will always be filtered in some way through a perspective. There will always be an element of curation in the documentation, and for this reason the documentation will never be absolute. The importance of the commentary, then, of the commenting on the show, is implied to be just as or probably more significant than the show itself. There's to be an imperfect documentation of an artifact through commentary, and so the commentary holds weight in that way over the artifact and the documentation. Interesting, too, I think that the speaker chose the medium of podcast to document a piece which is so nakedly visual. In fact, there is a reference in the first moment of the show to a visual artist, a painter, Alfred Stevens. The very form of documentation, then, seems to have a pointed nature to it, or at least a lucidity of the recent uptick in this form of housing, commentary on television shows episode by episode. I wonder if the show is an attempt to capitalize on the growing popularity or to comment on it, and if it's trying to comment on the form, if it in fact just becomes the form it's commenting on in trying to comment on it. I'll also mention here that there's an instance of verbal stumbling in this section, which is something that will happen fairly frequently in this first episode. The speaker stumbles over the word started, which holds its own sort of rhetorical implications in the notion that there's an unconscious stillbirthing from the speaker of their own language or ideas, which is something that will be reinforced by their constant diminishing of their own language. There's question, so many vague references to Finnegan's Wake in this episode, which it's clear that the speaker has perhaps read an appraisal of Finnegan's Wake, but certainly not the work itself. Of starting in the middle, which we finally see the highlighted or otherwise unusual word start appearing here, a ways into the episode, a little under 2 minutes in to be specific, not to mention that the episode begins in the middle of a sentence. There is then another unusual instance of personal judgment, in this case self-consciously framed as such, in regard to the larger cultural significance of Smith's point. The speaker describes Smith's point as something they believe to be a, quote, important touchstone in 1970s queer media. This is obviously a loaded naming of the position of Smith's point outside of the contained world of itself, and what I'd like to focus on most specifically right now is the use of the word touchstone, which by definition implies that Smith's point, to an extent, is a standard or microcosm for queer art in the 1970s, which, 10 years is a long period, firstly, another instance of generalized language from the speaker. And this raises debates around curation and commonality, specifically if something as unknown as Smith's point can be considered any sort of microcosm despite its general obscuredness at the time, and further, despite its current obscuredness. Does popularity and common knowledge have a place in practical theory? And if it does, should current popularity be considered for current practical theory, or should relative popularity be considered in a sort of Meet Me in St. Louis versus The Wizard of Oz situation? Further, the current and past esotericism of Smith's point makes the speaker's attempt at documentation more urgent, but the skewing of said documentation through commentary more ignoble than a straightforward presentation of facts and truth. The speaker then gives a long speech on the original title of Smith's Point, which was to be the Smith's Point Inn, presumably the original name of the inn featured on the show. This is a hypothesis I trust from the speaker because their reference to the Bill Craig papers is easily confirmable with some digging. The speaker goes in depth about the grammatical significance of the word the as it relates to the title of the show, specifically in establishing Smith's Point's architecture as a central mythic entity of passage versus the place's geography, which further extends into the narrative conflict between urbanization and nature in the show. I feel the speaker's use of the word nature in this case is too diminutive of what the ideology of central mythic passage might encompass, particularly as it pertains to the inn itself versus the ocean adjacent. Name theory is introduced here too as a concept, and the implications both in-world and out of renaming the home of the central characters. This feels an accurate appraisal, and I agree that there is something almost obstructive from changing the name of the inn from something descriptive to more of a kitschy pun that, because of the assumptions we can make about the writers, is a self-conscious kitsch on part of the production, but not on the part of the Harris family, which complicates the relationship between in and out of world intention. There's a brief discussion, too, of the passageway between the kitchen of the now-titled Do Come In and the Smith's Point Pint, which retained its name from the original concept, it's implied by the speaker. This discussion will become significant later in terms of the speaker's appraisals of thresholds in the first episode, and the passage both as a figurative and literal place of transience in terms of class and narrative. Unmentioned, I think intentionally, perhaps it's addressed in a later episode, is the fact that this passageway is only ever implied, and never directly alluded to or seen, making its very existence in question, which certainly adds a layer of something like obstruction or farawayness to the discussion of transience in Smith's Point. There's then some theorizing by the speaker as to why the name switch was made logistically, one possibility being that the writers of the show convinced Bill Craig to expand the potential location of the show to outside of the inn, the other being that one of the executives at ABC found the show's title to be unmarketable for one reason or another, possibly for being too esoteric. I can't find evidence to back either of these hypotheses, although logically they follow. This is speculation from the speaker based on assumed purpose, an idea that will come up later in regard to the mistakes made on Smith's Point, which, again, I question if it's an appropriate theoretical stance to take, as it also introduces the idea of double talk, that the speaker is saying to assume mistakes in the podcast are intentional. Further, it's one of the first instances of hypothesizing by the speaker which exists without much known evidence. In this case, it's a theorizing which acknowledges itself as such, something of a preparation for the broader figurative and narrative theorizing which will occur in relation to the internal plot of Smith's Point. Draw attention here to the reappearance of the word postmodern, which is used in relation to the speaker's appraisal of the name change. In this instance, I feel the word is used incorrectly, and that there's something of a false equivalency to name theory in postmodern literature and the name of the Smith's Point Inn. I acknowledge that this creates something of a conflict in the internal logic of my own appraisal of revisiting Smith's Point, as I do believe the speaker's appraisal of the character names within the show to hold academic probability and weight. The conflict in said theory, particularly as it pertains to descriptivism, I can make no sense of at all. I mean, clearly this is a person who does not know what a synecdoche is, nor someone who has likely even picked up the 1001 Nights, let alone have any kind of rightful lucidity of the implications of Scheherazade or sort of what her role is in relation to theories of metafiction, which is not even to mention the transparent difference between theories of frame narrative and theories of metafiction, which are two things made entirely separate from each other and which only collide or overlap in some specific circumstances. In terms of the external narrative of the podcast, it seems that this is a statement the speaker feels nervous about, perhaps because they know it to be untrue, in that there's an enormous change of tone and then a noticeable intake of breath after the phrasing. I can understand, I think, the maybe oblique connection between theories of infinite stories and Scheherazade, in that the 1001 and the title of the 1001 Nights is something of a synecdoche of infinity itself, which is sort of a philosophically bleak prospect understanding the frame of the story, in that Scheherazade is trapped in perpetual and infinite storytelling. But I think to call the 1001 Nights a metafictional story would be diminutive or inaccurate, as much as it did perhaps exist initially as an oblique criticism of the Sultan. So to call Scheherazade the mother of infinite stories would, I believe, be a defendable statement, but I don't know if there's weight in referencing her as the basis of metafiction, which even the statement itself is sort of vague in that it's unclear if the speaker is referencing her as the basis of all metafiction or the basis of something which grew into metafiction, which this is perhaps arguable in the 1001 Nights, but this position is never clarified. And further, this is a weird cut. Nor do I think that Candide even possesses any of the elements of noir. I research advisor Dr. Zod at Oslo Arts University. Didn't you hear me screaming?
Ryunosuke Akutagawa and the Old Potter's Tale. Okay, it's all very Baroque, but it's not the scene of particular interest to me, which is the second scene of the episode in which Melvin and Anne Olivia discuss fully the situation with April Eastman. This is primarily a scene of exposition, which more concretely births our understanding of Anne Olivia, Melvin, their relationship, the general plot of this episode, and also, subtly, the poor financial standing of the inn, which, we will note, serves as little more than additional stakes throughout the series. The Harris's fate is far more dependent on their popularity with general viewers than their business savvy. It's a scene that allows the viewer time to orient themselves and settle, one that would be unremarkable were it not for the speaker's inaccuracy in describing it. The speaker mentions that the curtains, made of fine gauze, are blowing in and out of the windows they cover during this scene, which is inaccurate. As of the version I watched on Vimeo, the windows in this scene were shut, and all the curtains, made of heavy navy velvet, were drawn. It seems unlikely to me that there would have been two versions of this scene filmed, with two separate sets of curtains, particularly given the show's initially low budget, and set dresser Stan Penrose's known attention to detail. There's question of the addition of deleted scenes not originally included with the broadcast in the Smith's Point box set, but never has it been suggested that multiple versions of episodes exist outside of these additions, nor that different scenes are intercut in different iterations of the box set. The only logical answer, then, is that the speaker is lying in this instance, possibly to further reinforce their theories around the themes of obstruction and Smith's Point as a cultural artifact. The irony is, then, that this lie completely discredits the rest of their commentary, and that it throws their trustworthiness as a speaker into question. So, we cannot assume that everything they say is true, which seems to undermine the intention of the podcast being for archival purposes. And I don't understand it. I don't understand why somebody would lie about something so innocuous. I don't know why someone would take the time to mention something so tedious and so dull if it wasn't even real, even to emphasize a point of some kind. But I've double-checked the Vimeo rip of the box set, and the curtains are drawn and made of heavy velvet material. The scene plays out as described, but there is no such movement from the curtains. I wonder if the speaker maybe misinterpreted waves of static from an old television screen or damaged tape as said curtains, but it seems unlikely. I've only done cursory research into the production of the box set for the first episode too, and it seems that only one version was made, so it's unlikely that the scene was swapped out between printings or packagings, but I wonder also, to be honest, if I am the one with the somehow altered, you know, box set or whatever, because dirty toilets.